Vishesha Sunyavari Pustachari Sutavani Umanjana Timbarandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chaksur Militum Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. So this afternoon we have in front of you from the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is called Dhyana Yoga, or Yoga of Meditation, text number 5, right? This is there? Text 5. So we have it here, so now we can chant this mantra. So I'll say each word, and you can say it after me, and then we'll respond, chant each pada, each half line, together. Translation. One must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. Now we'll read Srila Prabhupada's purport and then go back and discuss it. The word Atma denotes body, mind, and soul, depending upon different circumstances. In the yoga system, the mind and the conditioned soul are especially important. Since the mind is the central point of yoga practice, Atma refers here to the mind. The purpose of the yoga system is to control the mind and to draw it away from attachment to sense objects. It is stressed herein that the mind must be so trained that it can deliver the conditioned soul from the mire of nescience. In material existence, one is subjected to the influence of the mind and the senses. In fact, the pure soul is entangled in the material world because the mind is involved with the false ego, which desires to lord it over material nature. Therefore, the mind should be trained so that it will not be attracted by the glitter of material nature, and in this way, the conditioned soul may be saved. One should not degrade oneself by attraction to sense objects. The more one is attracted by sense objects, the more one becomes entangled in material existence. The best way to disentangle oneself is to always engage the mind in Krishna consciousness. The word he is used for emphasizing this point. That is, one must do this. It is also said, Mama eva manushyanam karanam bandhu mokshayaha karanam bandha mokshayo bandhaya vishayasango mukyai nirvishayam manaha. For man, mind is the cause of bondage, and mind is the cause of liberation. Mind absorbed in sense objects is the cause of bondage, and mind detached from the sense objects is the cause of liberation. That quotation is from the Amrita Bindu Upanishad 2. Therefore, the mind, which is always engaged in Krishna consciousness, is the cause of supreme liberation. So udaret atmanai atmanatmanam atmanatmanam udaret atmanatmanam natmanam avasarayet atmaiva hyatmano bandur atmaiva puratmanah. Udaret, one must deliver. In Sanskrit there's a verbal form called vidilin, which is the form of injunction. So when it is dictated that one must do something, it is so enjoined that this is what one ought to do by authority. called Vidhi Lin. So udarate, it's in that phrase, it's enjoined. One must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. So Prabhupada begins his discussion of this text by pointing out that the word Atma can denote body or mind or soul. He says it depends on the context. So this is important, because if you're studying this a little closely, you'd be a little confused, because udarat atmanatmanam, natmanam, the word atma is used in two different senses in this verse. Sometimes it is used in the sense of mind, and sometimes it is used in the sense of the soul. This is why you have to understand what's... You have to have some teaching authority to understand these texts. The reason the word Atma can denote body, mind, or soul, depending on context, is it means self. So sometimes the self is, the body is taken as the self. Now, of course, this is the illusion of the material world, that we identify the self with the material body. But even in casual conversation, our usage reflects that. Like if I cut my finger, I say, even though I know I'm not my body, I still say I hurt myself, when I didn't hurt myself at all. The soul can't be cut by any weapon. But still, conventionally speaking, the self can be taken as the body. Or in another context, the self can mean the mind. And finally, the self can mean the self proper, which is the soul. To complicate matters further, the super soul is also called Atma. Paramatma sometimes is given that distinctive prefix, Paramatma, but sometimes just Atma. Because really, the real self of all selves is in fact Krishna. But he is actually the self. You have to put a capital S on it, but Sanskrit doesn't have capital letters. But anyway, if you don't know what you're doing, it becomes confusing. So I remember reading a translation by some Western scholar of the Bhagavad Gita of this verse that said, one must deliver the self by the self and not degrade the self by the self. The self is the friend of the self and the self is the enemy of the self. Well, that sounded pretty interesting, but it was inscrutable. So it was intriguing, and there was once more that kind of oriental mysticism that everybody, wow, it must be profound, I can't understand it. But actually it has a quite precise meaning, which Prabhupada here is able to understand, that one must deliver Atmana by the mind, Atmanam, the self, the conditioned soul. He says conditioned soul here because the soul that needs delivering by hypothesis is conditioned. There's a liberated soul and there's no need to deliver. So that's why he says the conditioned soul. And by the mind. And not degrade or pull down the conditioned soul by the mind. For in fact, he says, the mind can go either way. It can be the bandhu, the friend, or it can be the ripu, the enemy. If it elevates or liberates or delivers, then the mind is our friend. And if it degrades us, it is our enemy. So he says, why is it that this is Atma here means the mind. He says, in the yoga system, the mind and the conditioned soul are especially important. Now, this chapter is especially talking about the Ashtanga yoga system. There are different kinds of systems of yoga. The word yoga, as Prabhupada points out many times, means to link or to join, to couple together. That's yoga. In fact, in Vedic astrology, the conjunction of two planets is called a yoga. And in fact, the English word yoke, as you yoke together two oxen, is a cognate of the Sanskrit word. Long process of history, it comes down from the Sanskrit word yoga. So yoga means linking. Linking the individual soul and the supreme soul. Now there are different systems of yoga practice. What people think of as yoga, most people in the West think of as yoga, is Ashtanga yoga. Ashtanga means that yoga with eight branches. Anga means a branch or a part or a division. Eightfold. Ashta means eight. Ashtanga. Ashtanga yoga. It also goes by the name of Raja yoga. And another name is Hatha yoga. Especially when just the beginning parts of it. Now this Ashtanga yoga system is originally intended for the liberation of the soul from the bondage of matter. Here we're discovering these things, body, mind, and soul. So those are the three sort of selves. One's the real self and the other two are the false self. The other two, the mind and the body, are the self by expropriation. But not really. The self is really the soul. But the conditioned soul has acquired a false self consisting of a body, a gross body, and a subtle mind. And his bondage is his attachment to the material world through this body and this mind. So the Vedas teach us that the ultimate end of human life is to become free from material bondage and to go become from birth and death in the material world. Because the soul, the actual self, is eternal and full of knowledge and full of bliss, but has acquired a false self which is temporary, which is subjected to ignorance and all kinds of miseries. So there's a problem. We are not meant for suffering because we're eternal, but we think of ourselves as temporary, and so therefore we are suffering. So we've acquired a false self, and that false self that we've acquired is this body and this mind. Now, we're at the time of death, we are liberated from the gross body. That's when we shuffle off this mortal coil. But we only shuffle off half of it. The gross coil, because we've got two bodies. We've got the outside body, and we've got the inside body. The outside body is this one that we see, and the inside body is the subtle body, or the mental body, made of the subtle elements, manas, buddhi, ahankara, which is all, it's called mind. So the gross body goes, but I retain the subtle body. The soul retains the subtle body. The subtle body, or the mind, is the repository, the storehouse, the warehouse, the archive of all ideas of sense enjoyment. It has received impressions from the senses of this is pleasure. Either the pleasure I enjoy or the pleasure I see other people enjoying, and it becomes filled with desires to enjoy in this material world. All these desires are stored and conserved within the mind. So because I have this material mind full of these ideas of sense gratification, so that when I leave this gross body, I retain my attachments. Therefore, I keep on the subtle body. And the subtle body has so many desires still in it, it acquires another gross body. And there's a kind of, there's this proper sort of interface, and it clicks in. Just as you see that, their receptors and cells have their receptors, and their little things come in. You've seen the computer simulations, you know. So, anyway, you get a body that fits on a gross body that fits on the subtle body, like a glove fits on a hand. And then you go again. Then there's birth, and so on. And the mind enjoys, and then that gross body falls apart because it's cobbled together out of matter. So it's like something made out of Tinker Toys or a Rector set or Legos or something. You know, it's put together, and so it falls apart. Somebody comes along and smashes it, and then you get another one, and another one, and another one. So although the liberation from the gross body comes very easily, the liberation from the subtle body is harder to do. Because the gross body goes, the subtle body acquires another one. And it's that acquiring and giving up and acquiring and giving up that constitutes mrityu samsara, the cycle of repeated birth and death in the material world. And finally, human life is a chance to get free from this cycle. So anyone who's advanced human being and doesn't want to live just like an animal anymore takes upon himself the duty of self-realization. So becomes free from the cycle of repeated birth and death in the material world. So that's what the yoga system is for. Is for liberation. So this verse particularly, this chapter, is talking particularly about the Ashtanga Yoga system, which is ultimately not recommended in the Bhagavad Gita. Although it is a bona fide yoga system, and although the general principles that we see operating in that yoga system applied to all yoga systems, still ultimately it's rejected. Arjuna rejects it, actually. And Krishna says, finally, if you become my devotee and practice bhakti yoga, then you're the best yogi. So it's automatically accomplished. So bhakti yoga is, of course, what's ultimately recommended in Bhagavad Gita, not this Ashtanga yoga or Jnana yoga or Karma yoga even. But anyway, this is the general principles of the yoga system are given, and they apply across the board. But the Ashtanga yoga system, it means eight steps. They're called yama. Let's see if I remember them all. Yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Yeah, that's it, eight. Those are the eight steps. Yama and niyama mean regulative principles. Yama means rules. Niyama means more rules. The things that you do and the things that you don't. Then asana, which means sitting postures. Now this yoga system, of course, this is what becomes famous. People learn how to sit in Padmasana and the Surya Namaskara, and so many different asanas are there for it's like gymnastics. If you happen to be arthritic and things like that, you got problems right off the bat. Anyway, that's those sitting postures. And if you turn the television on at different times, you can usually see some lady in leotards trying to take people through some of these asanas. And all over the city of Philadelphia, there are societies that are teaching this yoga system. But they start with asanas. They skip, as a rule, yama and niyama. Because, later on Krishna gives what is yama, niyama. To practice yoga, one should go to a secluded place. Not South Street or Philadelphia. You should be up there in the Himalayas. One should go to a secluded place and should lay kusagrass. This is before you do your postures. Lay kusa grass on the ground and then cover with the deer skin and a soft cloth. The seat should be neither too high nor too low and should be situated in a sacred place. And so on. One should hold one's body, neck, and head erect in a straight line and stare steadily at the tip of the nose. Thus, with an unagitated, subdued mind, devoid of fear, completely free from sex life, one should meditate upon me within the heart, he says. So what is this completely free from sex life? Find all these people that are practicing the asanas and find out how many have bothered to become first completely free from sex life. Brahmacharya. Devoid of fear. Well, that's especially you're out in the jungles and there are tigers and cobras and things like that. You have to be fearless to begin with. These are some of the preliminary qualifications that... So people are not serious about this yoga as a means of self-realization. It can help your health, that's all. These early things, these asana and pranayama, can go about keeping you from getting colds and other things like that, and arteriosclerosis. It's true. It's good for your health. But certainly the end of this yoga process is not good health. That's there so you won't be bothered with your body so you can go into meditation. Pratyahara, you withdraw the senses from the sense objects. That's where everybody stops pretty much. Pratyahara means your eyes are half closed, so you're not asleep, but you're not staring around at everything. And you, by pranayama, you slow the breathing of your body way down, and you withdraw your attention from the external world. You focus it on Krishna in the heart. Your mind has to be unagitated. You see, if the mind is agitated, then it's your enemy. Not only do you have to be free from sex life, and you pretty much have to give up food too. That's the other reason that pranayama slows your metabolism way down. So eventually, you know, you don't have to eat. You don't have to drink very much, and so on. This is for serious people, this yoga system. And there are a few people up in the Himalayas practicing it. but they're not really flying around on Air India and so on. Bad place for pranayama. It's only practical for these kind of people who go off. This age is not very conducive to this kind of yoga system. And therefore, it's a simplified, kind of degraded version is being sold to people. But it is, the point of this yoga system, and any yoga system, is to control the mind. He says, the purpose of the yoga system is to control the mind and to draw it away from attachment to sense objects. Because we have become addicts of enjoying sense objects. Compulsive, addictive behavior in which I think I am the enjoyer and these objects are mine to enjoy. And what happens is that even after we understand that they're bad for us, we still want them. Now the fact is that all sense objects are bad for us. I know people sometimes, they are actually like addicts of drugs of various kinds. And I read in some book how you can tell if you're an addict. And how you can tell you're an addict is even if you know it's bad for you and you don't want to do it, you do it anyway. So we're all addicts to sense objects. And in many cases, people are changing just from one addiction to another. I noticed this when I came to some drug rehabilitation house. And people have worked very hard and become free from this particular one. It was in Kensington. And people had had an affinity for industrial solvents. And that was the drug that was available cheap in 55-gallon drums. It was a factory neighborhood, you know. And so they cleaned the heavy machinery with these big solvent canned solvents, which came in 55-gallon drums. So the local kids, they used to just take the stuff and put it in a paper bag and whack themselves out and lose a lot of brain cells in the pot. But they became addicts. So I was trying to teach chanting Hare Krishna to a group of kids. But I noticed how everyone was smoking cigarettes, you know. They couldn't stop smoking cigarettes. And I've even seen people going around with a t-shirt that said, you know, drug free, and they're smoking cigarettes. Well, maybe it's not as bad an addiction. It doesn't kill you as fast as another addiction. But then there's cigarettes. Everybody, okay, that kills you, right? They're deadly. The government's forcing people to put a warning on the thing that's deadly, and I know it's deadly, and I know it's bad for me, but still, I take it. Right? But all objects of the senses are, in fact, deadly. That's what we find out, because here he says, here we're talking about the mind must be so trained that it can deliver the conditioned soul from the mire of nescience. So mire means, you know, mud and goop. Nescience means ignorance. So what is that mire of nescience? That mire of nescience is our false identification of the self with the material body. The basic fundamental teaching of the Upanishads that all different schools of Vedic thought agree to is that we are not these bodies. You may find disagreement over to what extent the individual soul is like or different from the Supreme Soul. But on this point, that we are spirit, we are not these bodies, everybody agrees. This fundamental understanding. This school of Ashtanga Yoga agrees. The school of Jnana Yoga agrees. The school of Karma Yoga agrees. The school of Bhakti Yoga agrees. We all agree. First thing is, aham brahmasmi. I am not this body. I am spirit. And it's this ignorance, not just a theoretical ignorance, but an existential ignorance, by which I am identifying myself with the gross material body that is the cause of all my suffering. All my suffering is unnecessary. And the chief of those unnecessary sufferings is called death. It says that the real problem of material existence, the real problem, are four. They are birth, and they are death, and in between there is disease and old age. The Veda said these are your real problems. Now come to grips with the real problems. You see, we don't really like to deal with the real problems. All over and over and over again, the branches of our government now, at least two branches, are all involved. Death and birth too, for that matter. They got a birth control provision in there. But even if they pass the most perfect legislation with the best medical care delivery system we got and the best crime prevention bill you can have, birth, death, old age, and disease are still going to go on, because they won't face directly what is the problem. We like to deal with them at one remove. Because when we face the problem in its stark reality, we then will throw up our hands in despair. So people, they don't like to deal with the death problem. They like to worry about things like health insurance or unemployment instead, because they think you can solve it by electing a Democrat or a Republican. Whereas no Republican, no Democrat, or no independent is going to save us from birth, death, disease, and old age. So these are the real problems of life. The people that have everything have birth, death, disease, and old age. And they're all suffering. So the Vedas diagnosed our condition, said these problems are ours because we have accepted a false idea of who we are. We identify ourselves with the material body. We are eternal. If we actually experienced ourselves, our real consciousness as it actually is, not as it is confined by our false identity, our false consciousness, but if we liberated our consciousness from the confines of material designations under which we have imprisoned ourselves, I am a man, I am a woman, I am an American, I am a Russian, I am old, I am young, I am black, I am white, I am this, I am that. We lost all those designations, gave them up, became free from them. We liberated ourselves from that false, all those false ideas of ourselves, then we would also experience ourselves as free from birth, death, disease, and old age. These are not happening to me because I am not this body. So it's one thing to understand that in a theoretical way that the soul is different from the body. That we can explain, how the soul is one thing. The consciousness is the symptom of the presence of the soul. The soul is not the mind. The soul is not the gross body. That can be explained in a theoretical way, and you can understand these categories, soul, mind, body, very clearly. We've explained them many, many times. The further thing is that this has to become realized knowledge. This theory, let's call it a theory, because it's like book learning. I am not this body. Theories are not just things you throw out. They are guides for action. This is true even in the material world. There's a germ theory of disease. It's a guide for action. So anytime a scientist gives you a theory, it's because you can do things with it. You can plug in laboratory results and predict future laboratory results, and you can get a handle and make things happen. If it doesn't work, you throw the theory out. So this theory, I am not this body, has to be tested by experience. It is a guide for the formation of character. It tells us the way to go by which we can actually have realized knowledge of the self. So that's why the yoga process is actually what puts that theoretical information into action. It shows us how to bring about the liberation of the self from matter, and consequently permanently solve all of our problems. So our problem at diagnosis is this false identification of the self with the material body. That false identification, which he calls here a false ego, is this desire to lord it over material nature. I've acquired a false self due to my desire to enjoy matter. Therefore, I accept this body, which is made of matter, as me. So this act of attachment to sense objects and the enjoyment of sense objects causes my identification of the self with the material body. That's the problem. There's a reason for being, I don't know, I guess devotees are sometimes thought of as ascetics. We also have yama and niyama, you know, no illicit sex, no meat eating, no intoxication, and no gambling. That we follow, we try to follow strictly. We struggle with these things, and gradually we become steady. And some of them are hard to give up, especially if you've been raised addicts from the cradle, practically speaking, if you're raised in this country. To be addicted to these things, to meat eating, to intoxication, to illicit sex, to time-wasting enterprises, gambling, television, so on. And it's getting worse, actually. As time goes on, people are becoming more and more addicted. So, hard to wean ourselves away from these things. But they're true addictions, because even if we understand that these are bad for me, and ultimately they're bad for us because those activities cause our bondage. They cause our identification of the self with the material body. Then whatever happens to the material body, this is happening to me. So the material body starts to grow old and decrepit. I think, my God, now I'm growing old. When the material body starts to break down and become infested with all sorts of diseases, I think, now I'm becoming diseased and sick and broken. And then when the material body dies, I think, now I'm being annihilated. And therefore we suffer. We don't want these things to suffer. Look at what people are trying to do to avoid it. The desperate, the lengths to which people will go to avoid old age, disease, and death. And of course you see that actually, although people will go to desperate lengths, the failure rate is 100%. That's why this material world is ultimately not a good place. There's just enough little happiness to keep you addicted. You know, it's really cunning. You know, I understand that drug pushers, when they want to get new customers, they find some kid and first they give him a lot of free dope. And he gets nice and hooked, and then all of a sudden the price comes up and he has to do so many things to get it. You know. So material nature is like that. At first, there's all, when you're young, there's all kinds of pleasure that seems to come all by itself. You become really attached. Then as you start to get older, it becomes, you have to pay a higher and higher price. Huh? It's true, isn't it? Yeah. So this is our situation, material. We've all become junkies. Not just to the various forms of obvious junk, but to any sense object. We've become addicts. And even after we sit here, we read Bhagavad Gita, and we understand, yes, this attachment is the cause of my death, still we engage in this repeated destructive behavior. So the yoga system is designed to put an end to this repeated destructive behavior. So the reason why we have to focus on the mind is this addiction takes place in the mind. The mind is in the subtle body. They're actually different divisions. It's called a mind, an intelligence, and false ego. So the mind, according to the psychology, this is Vedic psychology, and this is a kind of introspective psychology which is given to us by very advanced yogis who have explored the subtle body with far greater discrimination and insight than Western people have. They tell us, and also it's confirmed in the Vedas, that the subtle body has these three divisions: manas, buddhi, ahankara. So the mind, it says, is the area of habit. It's quite inertial. Like when we associate. You know, it's the realm of Pavlovian classical conditioning. Pavlov did the experiment, you know, when he rang a bell and fed the dogs and gave them an electrical shock or something, and then when he just gave them the electrical shock, they started to salivate and so on. Or he just rang the bell. The association of bell ringing with food caused the dog to salivate. So there was this kind of association. So this association takes place like that. And so in the mind we get these patterns or habits of sense gratification that is set up for a long time. Because the mind, simply its business is to accept and reject everything in terms of sense gratification. If something feels good, it's your mind that says, if it feels good, do it. And if it feels bad, go away from it. But something higher has to intervene. And that's called buddhi or intelligence. Because sometimes things that feel good and we want to do are very bad for us. And sometimes things that have immediately feel bad are good for us. But anyway, over the course of years, we develop habits of sense gratification. And so the mind becomes programmed in a certain way. It has been directed by the intelligence to see and